as I am sure you know, the Talmud requires interpretation. Its phrases conceal even as they reveal. Language is often brilliant and rarely direct. Language is carefully chosen. Often when you are through reading a page, you're not quite sure that you have fathomed its clear meaning. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger requires interpretation. His language conceals even as it reveals. His phrases are often brilliant, but rarely direct. His language is always carefully chosen, but when you've listened to his explanation, you're not quite sure that you fully fathom his purpose. Now, the second disengagement agreement, the second separation of force agreement between Israel and Egypt, for all intents and purposes, Dr. Kissinger's agreement. It is he who negotiated it in those long days of shuttle diplomacy. And the intricate pile of maps, of protocols, of treaties, of agreements, of understandings, verbal and written, is a typical Dr. Kissinger achievement. It bears all the hallmarks of his unique approach to foreign policy. And as I listened, as many of you did, to the days-long interpretation of Talmud by Dr. Kissinger before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, my mind inevitably made the association between that ancient masterwork and this contemporary treaty. And I move this morning to begin these comments on America and Israel and this time in our history by asking you to turn with me to the Talmud, to the third of the great tractates which compose it, which is known as Nashim, women, a tractate which contains for the most part the laws governing the status of women in marriage and divorce and such subjects, to turn with me particularly to one of the volumes within this tractate known as Kiddushin, laws of betrothal, of engagement. Turn to the end of the first chapter of this volume, in which the early sages of the Mishnah digress for a moment from the status of women during engagement to speak of the piety of reward and of punishment. And the text of the Mishnah reads, "Whosoever obeys a single commandment, it is accounted to him for good. His days will be prolonged, and he will remain secure in the land. And whosoever fails to abide by a single commandment, it will go ill with him. His days will be shortened, and he will be driven off of the land." Now, this is the familiar piety of the covenant tradition, our tradition. The righteous are rewarded, and the wicked are punished. But our tradition, of course, includes the book of Job, questions as from experience. All of us have seen the righteous whose lives are foreshortened. The righteous people, Israel, kept off of its land for tens of centuries. And as one might expect, one of the later sages immediately raises a question to the text based on his personal experience. He remembers a time when, some years back, a son, a dutiful son, fulfilling the commandment of Kavodav, of obedience to one's father, had heard his father ask him to climb the ladder into the attic of the barn and to release there some chickens that had been caught in the eaves, and to bring them down. And the son had climbed the ladder, and he had released the chickens. And as he had climbed down the ladder had collapsed under him, and he had been killed. Obviously, his days had not been lengthened, though he had quite apparently been fulfilling a commandment, kavodav, to be obedient to one's father. Now, the sages of the Talmud, quite like Dr. Kissinger, are infinitely capable at rationalizing away text, at giving new nuances to the apparent meaning of a text. How will they explain away this evidence? Well, one suggests that the son had gone off the ladder unwillingly, and so he really was not fulfilling a commandment the way commandments ought to be fulfilled. He was not under the protection of his goodness. And another sage suggests that, yes, he'd gone up to obey his father, and he'd done what his father had asked from him, but once the chickens had been released, as he came down the ladder, he was thinking inappropriate thoughts, and therefore he was no longer involved in the protection of his goodness. Now, there was, fortunately, in this particular school debate, a pragmatist, a realist. He makes the comment with which this particular section of Talmud closes, that in point of fact, the son was not fulfilling a commandment because he ought not to have listened to his father. One does not, he said, obey a commandment if that obedience requires that we place ourselves in the place of probable injury. Ladders in those days were made of lashings and of wood, and they often broke. And the young man simply ought to have said to his father, I can't do it, I shouldn't do it. He had placed himself in the position of endangering his life. And this sage quotes a Talmudic principle to the effect that one does not endanger oneself willingly in the hope and the certainty that God will perform a miracle for us in order to deliver us. One does not put one's trust in miracles. Be sensible. Be realistic. Protect yourself at all times. That's good Talmudic principle. Lo'lam lo ya'amod ish b'makom sakana. A man should never put himself in a place of danger for Yomer saying, Yiyeh li nes. A miracle will take place for me. Now, I'm sure that those Israelis and those of us who love Israel, who watched the Senate hearings, who listened to the text and to the infinite explanations of the text, wondered if Mr. Rabin and his government might not have placed Israel in a position of danger for which there is no out except to close one's hands and to pray to God for a miracle. Now, as you know, God has been known to perform miracles for Israel, but long ago, in different times, and one does not depend upon the miracle. Is the result of these negotiations so to weaken Israel that she really has little hope now of any survival in the long term except through a miracle? I think not. I think not yet. But if more such agreements are forced on Israel, the Talmudic principle may have to come into effect. And even a socialist premier in Israel may have to return to the wisdom of our religious fathers and say to Big Daddy, the United States, you ask me to be obedient, but I cannot. For to obey you further would be to expose my life needlessly, my people's lives, to danger. The public press has tended to portray Dr. Kissinger's role, at Dr. Kissinger's suggestion, I believe, as one of a man who seeks only to avoid a third world war, whose major purpose in this shuttle diplomacy was simply to encourage Egypt and Israel to do what their own anger and blindness and intransigence was precluding them from doing, to begin to negotiate with each other. And that, in point of fact, it's rather sad that these two Oriental countries could not do the simple thing, begin to talk with each other, without receiving first millions and even billions of dollars in bribes from the United States in order to achieve this purpose. It's as if we had to cross the palms of Sadat and Rabin with promises of aid before they would take a simple step towards making arrangements each with the other. Now, in point of fact, I'd like to suggest to you this morning that Dr. Kissinger's purposes in all of this were not altruistic, nor was he a peacemaker. If his concern were to prevent a third world war, the place to talk over that concern is in Moscow, not in Cairo, and not in Jerusalem. He doesn't have to jet about the Middle East in order to avoid a third world war. He has simply to begin to explore the possibilities of wheat and of oil and of arms limitation and the psychology and the impact of detente. There are 100 ways for him to avoid a third world war. That he has now three times in a year's time spent weeks of precious time, not in Moscow, and not in Peking, and not in the capitals of the Western world, and not in Washington, but in the relatively insignificant capitals of the Middle East, in Amman, in Damascus, in Jerusalem, and in Cairo, suggests what is, in fact, I believe, the case. Throughout these negotiations, Secretary Kissinger had an active American agenda. It was this that he wanted to achieve. And that Israel was encouraged to accept the withdrawal and the various promises of aid because it was to America's profit and advantage that Israel accept these promises. You recall, in March of this year, Dr. Kissinger spent about 12 days in the Middle East, shuttling about, trying to arrange the second separation of forces agreement, which was finally initialed in September and signed in October. He failed. He came back to Washington empty-handed. And when he came back empty-handed, you'll recall they immediately announced in Washington that there was to be a major policy reassessment of America's relationships with the Middle East. Now, the label policy reassessment was a convenient word to say simply that we are angry with Israel for not having done what we would have wanted her to do. And though we will continue to ship the various arms that were promised before now, there will be no further talk of arms shipments or arms sales or of foreign aid until an effective agreement has been reached. Now, America had at that time no arms sales or arms agreements with Egypt or the other confrontation states. There was no agreement as to aid to these countries. And so effectively, the policy reassessments take place all the time. You don't have to announce them. But the announced policy reassessment was simply a pretext to bring pressure on Israel to do what Israel obviously did not feel was in its own best interest, but what America felt was in our best interest. Israel has always believed that the way to peace in the Middle East is through direct negotiations with her neighbors. That there's no other shortcut and no other technique which will work. Dr. Kissinger intruded himself between the contending parties. He did so for a purpose. And this purpose is uniquely to our advantage. And I'd like to suggest that the goals that Dr. Kissinger sought are these profitable goals for the United States. When the Yom Kippur War of 1973 broke out, America was the major support of Israel and Russia was the major support of Egypt and of Syria, of the enemy. And American business before October of 1973 was effectively precluded in many of the Arab states for bidding for the various contracts for development, for oil, for mineral mining that were being offered. France, Germany, England, states which had taken a more neutral line were more acceptable in that part of the world. And American banking interests and American business interests were in fact being excluded. And our businessmen didn't like it one bit. But they didn't bring great pressure on the United States on the United States government before this time because there was not great wealth in the Arab world. But then came the arms embargo, and then came the oil embargo. And suddenly oil was costing four times what it had been cost before, and suddenly we saw the possibility of the shift of billions of dollars of currency, of capital, from West to Middle East. And suddenly the contracts that were being offered in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Kuwait and countries such as this were not in terms of millions of dollars, but in terms of tens of millions of dollars. And suddenly the bankers of the United States were determined that the banks of Europe should not be the agencies through which these dollars were recycled into the West. They wanted the major piece of the action. And events had so worked out at the end of the October War that Egypt had pushed Russia aside, was turning towards the United States. And the United States saw an opportunity to play a new role in the Middle East, a role which would be to the advantage of American business. A role in which America would seem to be friendly to both parties. It was called, for want of a better term, even-handedness. And the possibilities of even-handedness meant simply that America would proclaim herself to be the friend of all, eager to help the development of the Arab world and the needs, legitimate needs of the Arab world, quite as much as she was determined to help the legitimate needs of the little state of Israel. And even-handedness has been the key of American policy since October of 1973. But to prove America's even-handedness, rather than simply to proclaim it, American policy had obviously to achieve something of benefit to the Arab world, which they could not have achieved on their own. The end of the October War, Israeli forces sat on the west bank of the Suez Canal. The end of the October War, Israeli forces had captured Golan up through and including Quneitra. They were within 25 miles of Damascus. And the first proof of American even-handedness was, in effect, the order to the Israelis to withdraw east of the canal. And the second proof of American even-handedness was the encouragement of Israel to engage in the 1974 first separation of forces of agreement, which returned Quneitra to the Syrians and the banks of the Suez Canal to the Egyptians. And the State Department discovered a very popular phrase with which to explain what Israel was encouraged to do. Israel was encouraged to risk for peace. Now, the only risk Israel was taking was the risk of losing American support if she didn't do what America wanted her to do. Very little peace emerged from the first separation agreement. There was a buffer zone between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Syria, but the Egyptians proceeded to reduce the amount of time the United Nations Expeditionary Force was to remain The Syrians continue to shell across the line. The boycott, economic and political, worldwide activity against Israel was stepped up. According to that first separation of forces agreement, Israeli-bound cargo was to be allowed to proceed through the Suez Canal. It was never so allowed to do. Israel was encouraged in the West to risk for peace because the West, particularly the United States, wanted an opportunity to bid for the billions of dollars which the East now had to invest. Because there was a great market now for our military supplies in that part of the world, and because we could say to the West, particularly to the American people, that by becoming friendly with the Arabs, we are to a degree securing that percentage of our oil supply which comes from that part of the world. It was to achieve these ends that Dr. Kissinger has three times now spent weeks in the Middle East, to achieve markets and profits for American business, to secure the supply of oil, and so far that can be secured, and to see to it that the relationship of America with the Arab world, particularly with the middle and southern tier of the Arab countries, is maintained at a happy enough level that the Russians will not be invited back in by those countries. That's the American agenda. And that's why the American Secretary of State has been busy in the Middle East. And though it may in fact work out that there is an opportunity for peace in this second disengagement agreement, that is, Israel has taken risks, perhaps they may bring some peace, that question is highly problematic. Because instead of focusing on the whole problem, on coming to some kind of overall solution where Israel's political needs and military needs are supported, as well as simply Israel returning geography and oil to the Arab world, only a very small part of the puzzle has been touched. What's happened? Israel has agreed to pull back beyond the one defensible piece of real estate between the Suez Canal and her own settlements within the pre-1967 borders. There's nothing but flat land between the passes and the pre-1967 boundaries of Israel. She no longer has visible, eyeball, telescopic vision of what's happening on the other side, on the western side of the passes. At a time when oil is the staff of life to a modern nation, Israel has returned to the Egyptians the one oil field which was within her control. And she's done that without any treaty assurance, with only a verbal assurance from an American administration that if the Iranians should cut off Israel's oil supply, the United States will resupply her. Israel has received certain kinds of verbal assurances as to arms and to aid and as to oil from the United States. But when the Congress of the United States debated the 200 technician legislation, the requirement of this agreement that 200 technicians be placed at two observation points in the passes area, in the mountains area, to report both to Israel and to Egypt about troop movements, to avoid the danger, to minimize the danger of a surprise attack, the Congress of the United States tacked on an amendment to this legislation which said, in effect, that this passage of this legislation specifically exempted Congress from agreement with any statement, protocol, understanding, every possibility was listed in the text that was had otherwise been agreed to by the administration. Congress had not put their imprimatur, their assent, on any other agreement save this one. Whatever the administration had said, an administration had said, Congress had not assented. Now, Israel has been asked by the United States to risk her defenses, to risk her oil supply, for the sake of American profits and American geopolitical advantage. The argument is that what's good for the United States is ultimately good for Israel. Now, whether or not this is the case is really the issue before the American people, before the court of the world. Whether Rabin had any other choice but to do what he did do is problematic. Between March, when the first attempt to create this new disengagement agreement failed, and September, Premier Sadat did not make any further concessions. America simply discovered that she was willing to sweeten the kitty a bit, to add some tens of billions and millions of dollars more of aid and of promises of more sophisticated armor. America realized that in order to maintain her purposes in the Middle East, she had to encourage Israel a little bit more than she had. But peace, I wonder. The peace depends on Mr. Sadat meaning what he says to the foreign press, that ultimately Israel accepts the proposition of Egypt accepts the proposition of coexistence with Israel. He doesn't always say that to his own people. It assumes that Mr. Sadat, even if he believes this, can, believing this, remain in power. Egypt is not a stable democracy. And there is a radical and there is a reactionary opposition in the military and among the radical groups to any agreement with Israel. It assumes that he can escape assassination by the radical forces in the Arab world. I remind you that just a year ago, these forces assassinated in Cairo a Jordanese foreign minister with whom they disagreed. And just 2 weeks ago, they attacked the Egyptian embassy in Moscow to express their anger against the Egyptian move. All of this agreement is tied up quite clearly in the mind of Mr. Sadat with what is called further progress on other fronts towards a return of the condition to what it was at least in 1967. And very clearly, Syria particularly is not prepared to enter into new disengagement agreements with Israel. Mr. Assad flew to Moscow on Friday of last week, and after just 24 hours there, came back truculent and claiming that Syria would not admit the validity of this present agreement and had no intentions whatsoever in engaging in any further understandings of a temporary nature, in fact, of any nature, with the so-called state of Israel. Now, the American government, in order to maintain its friendship, its talking points, its contract points with the Arab world, has got to see to it that under its auspices, further progress is made towards peace, in quotation marks, towards a return of Israel to the borders of 67, or to the borders of 48, or to no borders at all. How America will achieve this end, given the Syrian position, and the Russian position, not to speak of the position and the armament of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, remains a great question mark. That America must make good on this tacit promise to the Arab world is very clear. As President Ford signed the other day the legislation which empowered him to get 200 volunteers and to assign them to the observation stations in the Middle East, he said straight out, the United States will not tolerate stagnation or stalemate in the Middle East. Well and good. But if he has no ability to leverage Syria, and if he has no standing with the radical forces in the Arab world, how is he going to avoid stagnation and stalemate? Obviously, the only way is to bring pressure on Israel for certain kinds of further unilateral concessions, to risk more for American profits, to risk more for peace. The situation that Israel finds herself in, it's a dangerous one. These are anxious times for Israel. Yes, there are certain short-term advantages for Israel in the present agreement. Israel will receive, if Congress agrees to it, some $2+ billion of foreign aid, most of which will immediately be recycled to the United States in terms of arms purchases. And there has obviously been an understanding that there will be consultation and agreements between the governments. And Israel has some understanding with our State Department that if her oil supplies are cut off, as long as it's feasible, oil will be gotten to Israel. But that's the short term. The longer question, the more basic question, is are we any closer to peace than we were a year ago? I think not. I think the Israelis have been completely correct in their assessment of the situation when they say that there can be no piecemeal arranging of things if someone is interposing themselves between the enemies. The agreements will ultimately have to be worked out directly, face to face. And this, in effect, Dr. Kissinger's methods of operation is precluding, making impossible. It's he who's doing the arranging. And he has his own agenda to achieve. Now, the Congress of the United States has specifically said that they do not accept the obligations as law, as treaty law, entered into between the United States and Israel and the United States and Egypt in these last negotiations. It doesn't mean that when the time comes and money is asked of Congress, as it will be later this fall, Congress may not in fact vote the money. I have in fact greater confidence that the Congress of the United States will do what the administration has agreed to than I have that the administration will, in the long term, support and understand what it means to be supportive of the security and the survival of Israel. But it's going to be hard. This is not a Congress of 10 years ago of an affluent America. This is a Congress which is being asked every day to supply money to our cities and to welfare. Why should $2-3 billion when you had Egyptian loans and Syrian loans and American loans go overseas when we don't have enough money for our own domestic needs or seemingly don't have? It's a post-Watergate, post-Vietnam Congress, which does not trust the administration. If you want to symbolize the distrust which exists between the Congress and Dr. Kissinger, the Congress and the administration, you had only to watch what was in effect a schoolboy exercise as the Senate Foreign Relations Committee had Dr. Kissinger in the seat for 2 days, forcing him day by day to go line by line through the text, through the agreements, verbal, written, and otherwise, so that they came to understand as much as could be understood of the professions and of the promises and of the pledges which he had made. This Congress will not willingly or easily grant this aid, nor will it willingly or easily make it possible for America to come to the military support or the tactical support of Israel if such should be necessary. One of the provisions of the agreements made both with Egypt and with Israel by the United States is an agreement that in case of violation of this second phase, the United States will act in consultation with the offended party and take whatever remedial actions are necessary. And it's quite clear that this Congress is far more isolationist in spirit than any that has been in recent years. It's quite difficult to conceive of this administration getting from this Congress assent to use our Marines to take some other kind of action if such were in fact deemed necessary. Israel has risked for peace without any sure assurance from the United States that she will make good on the promises and on the pledges which have been made. Now, the administration made these pledges. But these pledges were made at a time which is very much different since the October War of 1973. Before that war, the Middle East was not our territory. After that war, much of the Middle East again became within the American sphere of influence. It's now ours to milk, to sell to deal with. Even-handedness, more than ever before, is the statement of our national policy. Yes, we are committed in terms of national policy to the security and to the survival of Israel. The very existence of an Israeli army is what's saving Lebanon today. But we're also committed to the prosperity and to the profits which are available in the Arab world. We're also committed to try and deny Russia naval bases in the Persian Gulf and further oiling privileges in the Mediterranean. We have many, many irons in the fire. In 1973, when the October War broke out, it took us 4 days before we agreed to begin to resupply Israel by an airlift. I wonder, in this new atmosphere of even-handedness, how long it will take the experts in the State Department to decide that the situation has become so desperate that an airlift is needed to provide Israel the wherewithal to continue. It's very clear that time is of the essence as far as the United States is concerned. The present agreement, 3 years. Egypt has agreed to allow the United Nations Expeditionary Force to remain for a year and to look with favor on renewals for 2 more years. 3 years. 3 years to provide for movement towards further negotiations, further withdrawals by Israel. How is the United States to achieve that? What unilateral concessions will this government begin to demand of Israel, for what dollars, for what aid? I'm afraid that the policy of reassessment, the tacit and covert pressures exerted on Israel up till September of this year, from March to September, will be repeated from time to time in order to make Israel more amenable to recognize the truth that what's in America's interest is in fact in Israel's interest. Up till October of 1973, the United States was prepared to provide Israel with technological weapons, which in effect gave her some military advantage. She's, after all, a country of 3 million people. The Arab world numbers 150 million of people. Arab armies, in terms of sheer number, are vastly more numerous, and they are as well equipped in terms of tanks and cannons and missiles. The United States, up till October of 73, provided Israel with some of the most advanced communications equipment in the world, some of the best fighters in the world. But now there seems to be a new doctrine, which was enunciated some weeks ago by Secretary of Defense Schlesinger, when he said, yes, the United States has the obligation to provide Israel with the military equipment with which to maintain her defenses, but we have no obligation to provide Israel with arms which will overawe her enemies. Which is to say that Israel is not to get the Pershing missile. Which is to say that Israel is not to get weapons which are more advanced than those which exist in the Arab armory. Which is to say that what the Arabs get first will be the measure against which America's grant of military aid to Israel will be measured. Israel will always be at the disadvantage, behind, never ahead. Goliath is always to be better equipped than David. And very clearly, the technological skills of Israel are limited. Iran is now training Egyptian pilots in the various advanced forms of American fighter interceptors and bombers. Saudi Arabia is now training Egyptians in certain kinds of missile training, which were heretofore available only from Russian technicians. The United States is training the naval officers for the ships which we are about to and have sent to the Egyptians. Technically, in terms of competence, the Arab world is fast catching up with Israel. And now the United States, in the name of even-handedness, has set a new standard. We will supply Israel only when it can be shown that the others already have equivalent arms. These are anxious times, and the future is uncertain. It's going to be a future in which the relationship between the United States and Israel will not be one which will be easy or clearly defined. Israel is significant to the national interest. America needs the Israeli army to protect the integrity both of Jordan and of Lebanon. Israel is the one secure, advanced air base we have with which to defend Iran. Israel has a tactical army of great potential usefulness. Israel has an army which can often test in battle American weapons. But there's a limit now to the commitment of American national interest to Israel. We are committed both to Israel and to Egypt. Mr. Sadat is coming to Washington, as you know, in 2 weeks' time, and he's bringing with him a shopping list of arms. And though Mr. Kissinger has said that we're not prepared now to get into specifics with him, it's clear that Sadat has been promised American arms. And in the next war, we may see repeated the tragedy we saw in the Indian-Pakistani War and elsewhere in our world of American arms fighting American arms. American arms in the hands of Israelis fighting American weapons in the hands of Egyptians. We may find American officers training Israeli officers and Egyptian officers at the same base in the same equipment with which to kill one another when they get back to the Middle East. It's clear now that the United States has defined her interest in the Middle East as both and, both to support Egypt and to support Israel, both to support Saudi Arabia and to support Israel, both to support the oil sheikdoms and to support Israel, both to support Jordan and Lebanon and to support Israel. And the risk in that for Israel is great. How long will it take the experts in the State Department to decide if there should be another flash war, and wars always come with a flash, that it was Israel that was attacked, or that Israel simply was responding to an imminent attack? How long before they sort out this complex of interests? Israel is strong. The aid will be useful. Israel is in no immediate danger, internally or externally, of collapse. It may be that the very complicated arrangements which will now begin to take place in that world will fit in with what Americans like to think of as the complex, labyrinthian methods of bargaining and of arrangements which exist in the Levant. I'm not sanguine of that. But certainly this much is true. That this is a time in which all Americans who are concerned for moral and spiritual and human reasons with the survival of Israel will have to stand up and be counted. There are all kinds of pressure groups now at work in our country who are determined that when push comes to crunch, the balance is to be weighed in favor of profits and of oil. The big banks, big development, overseas development corporations, even to a certain degree the labor unions who will profit by sales abroad. All of these now have a profit instinct which tells them that somehow where the markets are, there the American national interest is. And if American Jews and those who understand in the larger world are not organized and determined and verbal and effective, the lobbies which are already in the field, the very effective lobbies, the manufacturers and the oil companies, military industrial complex, and all of them will have the day all to themselves. And it's very clear to me also that the Israelis are to go very slow and drag their heels. Test. both in terms of a world public opinion, if it has any meaning given the state of the United Nations today, and in terms of their own survival. Israel would do well to say again and again to the United States, "Hab nicht." Don't force the issue. Let's test whether or not Sadat means what he says, whether cargo will pass through the canal. Let's test whether he will keep the heavy cannon, the missiles, out of the demilitarized zone. Let's test what he... any further agreement under your aegis. Rabin must play for time. He must ask for assurances, the test of experience. And it will not be easy. If he plays for time, this will be interpreted by the United States and by the press of the United States as intransigence, obstinacy. Why is Israel always standing in the way of new negotiations for peace? As I've tried to say to you from the beginning, these negotiations do not have as their primary aim peace. The primary aim is profit. Peace negotiations will take place in Geneva or someplace like that, when Egypt, Syria, and the others are willing to sit down. Then and only then. And they will take place when the United States is prepared to give some ironclad guarantees to Israel, which the United States has never been prepared to do, and which is very hard to see our country doing given the present mood. Let me close as I began by returning to the Talmud. The Talmud wants to be precise. What is a makom sakana? What is a place of danger? And one of the examples given is a bridge. Bridges in those days were matters of wood, lashed together with wood. They were swept away by the torrents. The footings often rotted. The cordage gave away. A bridge was a place of danger. The rabbis asked, well, why is a bridge a place of danger? And they knew very little of engineering, of metal fatigue, of stress, and the like. So one of them said, well, it's a place of danger because so many people cross over the bridge, and because some of these people are sinners and reprobates or heathen, and God may want to destroy them and decide the moment they're on the bridge, that's the most convenient way of doing it. But thank God in the Talmud, the final answer usually is given to the hands of some realist. And there's a certain Rabbi Yanai, whom I know nothing else about except this, that when they had this long discussion of why bridges are places of the possible injury, dangerous places, he listened to all the theology and all the metaphysical speculation. He says, gentlemen, it's very simple. He says, yes, a bridge is a place of potential danger. And I want you to know, before I ever cross a bridge, I go underneath and I look at the pilings and I look at the cords that tie the bridge together. And only when I'm certain that everything's in place as it should be, only then do I put my foot on the bridge and cross. That's the advice I would give to Mr. Rabin. To make sure that this agreement is in place, its footings, the cords that bind it together. And then, and only then, to consider further agreements, partial agreements, with the nations which surround him. These are dangerous, dangerous times, dear friends. And I know that each of us will do what he can do and what needs to be done in order to make neighbors and members of our community and those who have voices and votes that count understand that there is something in this world more important than profit, people. There are 3.5 million people whose lives depend upon American honor, who have accepted American reassurances offered again and again, as they were offered to the Vietnamese, as they've been offered elsewhere in our world. Who depend upon the American word. And I pray that our country will not dishonor
those pledges and that word. Amen.